Well, several who are traveling, so let's remember to keep them in our thoughts and our prayers. Welcome to our visitors. It's good to see familiar faces and new faces with us here today. So thank you for being with us and encouraging us. We pray that we're an encouragement to you as well. Thank you to the men who served in the service leading up to this point, leading in song, leading in prayer, and serving at the Lord's table. Chase, thank you for that reading from Isaiah. You know, that's an important perspective. And it's really amazing that everything, obviously, that the prophet said would happen to the Savior happens. And that's an important perspective to remember, that that was foretold, that was prophesied. So Chase, thank you for sharing that with us and putting us in the proper perspective and mindset to engage in that important commemoration, the sacrifice that was made for us. We surely appreciate that. That brings us to our lesson today, part two of our short series on the book of Ruth. Last week, we focused on the first two chapters. We'll complete this lesson today by focusing on Ruth chapters 3 and 4. Yesterday, I heard Wendy and Sarah talking together in the kitchen, and Sarah reminded Wendy that the topic of today's sermon would be the last part of the book of Ruth, to which Wendy reminded her that she had missed the first part last week. So Sarah responded, "Well, I guess last week that means you were ruthless." So I thought it was pretty good. You know, she gets her sense of humor from her old man. So, sadly, probably for her case. But at any rate, we're going to complete our study. We'll follow a similar pattern. We'll read through each chapter. We'll pause after each passage and reflect on some of the finer points, some of the cultural aspects that are at play in this amazing story. But then, more importantly, what we can apply. And as we were reminded last week, it's so applicable and so relatable, because here we read about three people, Naomi, her daughter-in-law Ruth, and a man named Boaz, who were ordinary people. Compared to so many of these fascinating people that we study about in the Old Testament, many of which we'll study in our series on Hebrews chapter 11, who witnessed these amazing things, the amazing power of God, these miraculous events. And although we have much to learn from them, sometimes it's a challenge to relate. But here in these three people, we can see ourselves. We see normal everyday issues that they're dealing with that we can relate to. And we'll take our lesson from that. Before we do, let's do a quick review. I kind of used a movie theme last week, if you recall. So I suppose if I was doing that, then I would preface this by saying previously in the book of Ruth. And so in chapter 1, we're introduced to the two primary characters at the beginning, Elimelech and his wife Naomi, who live in Bethlehem. And because of a drought, a famine, they decide to pack up their two sons and leave the country and go to Moab, just to the east of Israel. In so doing, they are violating the old law, which states that the God's people weren't to mix with foreigners, especially foreigners who worshipped false gods, and certainly weren't to intermarry with foreign families, with foreign people. And that's what Elimelech and Naomi did, and their two sons went with them and married Moabite women, one named Orpah, one named Ruth. Well, Elimelech dies, and then the two sons die, leaving Naomi as a widow with her two widowed daughters-in-law. Naomi decides to go back home to Bethlehem. She hears there's food now. The famine has ended, so she decides to go home. And Ruth and Orpah come with her. At some point in the journey, though, she urges them to go back to Moab. Go back home to your own people. Find a husband, have a family, find happiness among your people. She also provides a bit of foreshadowing in that she tells the two women that I have no sons for you to marry. The statute of the old law, this custom that had derived from it, which we'll actually look a little bit closer at later in this lesson, that says if a man died, that his brother was to marry the widow and take her into his family. She says, I have no one to fill that role for you. It will be very difficult for you as a foreign woman to go and find a husband and start a family in Israel. So Orpah takes her up on that, and she departs, but Ruth stays with Naomi. She makes this beautiful declaration of her commitment to her mother-in-law. She accompanies her to Bethlehem. That brings us then to chapter 2, where Ruth is out in the farm fields gathering food to provide for herself and her mother-in-law. That is a right that she has given to her by the old law. So she's following that. She's picking food in a man's field named Boaz. Her and Boaz have a conversation. There's an initial attraction that's starting to develop here. Boaz tells her to come and glean in my fields. I will make sure that you have everything you need. Ruth asks, why are you being so kind to me? And he says, because I know what you're doing for your mother-in-law. And I know how important that is, and I respect that. He tells her that I am blessing you on behalf of the Lord. I am passing on that blessing. Ruth goes back home and tells Naomi that she has been working in Boaz's field. And it occurs to Naomi at the end of chapter 2 that Boaz is related to her late husband Elimelech. He can fill the role of what would be known as a kinsman redeemer, or in Hebrew, a goel. So we end chapter 2, how we ended the lesson last week, with somewhat of a cliffhanger. What will happen? How will Naomi and Ruth determine whether Boaz is willing to make that commitment, and will he in fact agree to do that? And that brings us to our lesson today at the beginning of chapter 3. So if you turn there, we're going to start by reading chapter 3, verses 1 through 5, where Naomi devises this plan to identify whether Boaz is willing to fulfill that role of Ruth's redeemer. So Ruth chapter 3, verses 1 through 5, as we begin our lesson. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to Ruth, my daughter, shall I not seek security for you, that it may be well with you? Now Boaz, whose young women you were with, is he not our relative? In fact, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Therefore, wash yourself and anoint yourself, put on your best garment, and go down to the threshing floor, but do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. Then it shall be, when he lies down, that you shall notice the place where he lies, and you shall go in, uncover his feet, and lie down, and he will tell you what you should do. And Ruth said to her, all that you say, I will do. We go back to the beginning of the chapter where Naomi makes her intentions known. What's her motivation? And depending on what translation we read from, it says that she's seeking security or rest or a home for Ruth. And that is a noble intention. She's trying to reciprocate the love that Ruth has shown for her, that dedication. She wants the best for her daughter-in-law. She sees potential in that Boaz is a relation of her former husband or her late husband. And so she's committed to finding the best solution for her daughter-in-law. That's her motivation. And she comes up with a plan. Now, let's think about that plan for just a few minutes, because there are differences in opinion, and there are different theories as to what Naomi is actually encouraging her daughter-in-law to do. And we'll look at both extremes, and I'll leave it to you to kind of make up your mind, because people are split on what Naomi is really recommending for Ruth to do. One opinion on one extreme is it may be what it sounds like. Go get dressed up nice. Go in the dark, lay down with Boaz, and he'll know what to do. That in fact, or in theory, she is telling her daughter-in-law to go proposition Boaz. That there might be a physical relationship that a marriage would stem from. And that's certainly an opinion. That's certainly a possibility. There's another opinion kind of at the other extreme. That there's something cultural happening here. And that this is a way that symbolically, but very importantly, Ruth will ask Boaz if he's willing to redeem her. And as we read going forward, it seems like, at least in my opinion, that's where I would go. That's where I would drift toward that course of action. And the way that would work is that, in fact, in this theory, should I say, Naomi is telling Ruth, dress up nice like you're going to a wedding. Put on your wedding clothes. Put on your best clothes. Go to him and lay down at his feet and uncover them. Because we'll read in the very next passage, that's what she does. Doing exactly what Naomi says, she lays down at Boaz's feet. Culturally speaking, this is a sign of respect. It's a sign of commitment, and it's a sign of submission. Remember in chapter 2, when Ruth and Boaz first spoke, she knelt down at his feet and said, why are you being so kind to a foreigner? Well, she would mirror that posture at the threshing floor that night so that when Boaz wakes up, he sees a woman who he already knows from their interaction in his field. She's dressed in her wedding clothes, and that gives her an opportunity from this position of respect to ask him, will you be my husband? Will you redeem me as a close relative of my mother-in-law's late husband? It would give her the opportunity to do that. I lean toward this course of action as well because that's what happens in the next passage. We see two people committing themselves to one another in a way that would be acceptable to God. And I would leave that at that point. It really doesn't matter what Naomi's intention was. What matters is what we read next. What did Boaz and Ruth actually do? Because we'll see that we know their hearts, that two godly people will do the right thing. They'll do what's appropriate, and they're going to commit themselves to each other in a way that God would respect and God would want them to do. So we can leave that conjecture behind. I'll leave that to your own opinion, but let's move forward as Ruth goes to the threshing floor and she makes her intention known to Boaz. We'll read verses 6 through 13. As the men were in harvest season, they would harvest the crop, they would take it and thresh it, they would winnow it in a facility, and they would tend to sleep there that night. They're trying to make as much hay as they can, pardon the pun, using as much daylight as they could. So they'll sleep at the threshing facility so they can get up bright and early the next morning and get right back to work. There's also some celebration that occurs. They're also watching over their harvest. They're guarding it. And so that's the setting as we continue the story in Ruth chapter 3, verses 6 through 13. So Ruth went down to the threshing floor and did according to all that her mother-in-law had instructed her. And after Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was cheerful, he went to lie down at the end of a heap of grain. And she came softly, uncovered his feet, and she laid down. Now it happened at midnight that the man was startled and turned himself, and there a woman was lying at his feet. And he said, "Who are you?" And so she answered, "I am Ruth, your maidservant. Take your maidservant under your wing, for you are a close relative." And he said, "Blessed are you of the Lord, my daughter, for you have shown more kindness at the end than at the beginning, and that you did not go after young men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you have requested, for all the people of my town know that you are a virtuous woman. Now it is true that I am a close relative, however, there is a relative closer than I. Stay this night, and in the morning it shall be that if he will perform the duty of a close relative for you, good, let him do it. But if he does not want to perform that duty for you, then I will perform the duty for you as the Lord lives. Lie down until morning." So, Ruth makes her request. Boaz wakes up in the middle of the night, sees Ruth at his feet. She takes the opportunity to ask him if he would redeem her. No matter what Naomi's intention was, this is what Ruth does for Boaz. She offers herself as his bride, and now it's up to him to decide if he's going to make that commitment or not. She does it in a poetic way. Because in most translations, it says, "Spread your wings over me." Some translations say, "Spread your garment over me." Remember that in chapter 2 and verse 12, when Ruth asked Boaz, "Why are you being so kind to me?" Boaz says, "It's because you're being kind to your mother-in-law, and God is blessing you." He used that same language. He said, "You came to Israel under God's wing." She's using that same language. "Take me under your wing. Make me part of your family. Protect me, provide for me." And of course, Boaz is interested in doing this. But here's another reason why this story is so relatable, because just when it seems like everything is going to fall into place, there's another wrinkle. Sometimes it seems like nothing can be easy, but if we stay committed and we think through things the way the Lord would have us, He will make sure that everything lines up. Because Boaz states the fact, which must have escaped Naomi, that there's another relative of Elimelech who's a little bit closer than he is. That man, in effect, would have the right of first refusal. So what we see here is Boaz committing to doing this the right way. And that's a lesson for us as well. He will be honest. He will be forthright. He will do this the way that God would have him do it as a righteous, godly man. Think about all the ways he could have done it. He could have just said, "Well, we're going to elope. Let's just run off. I love you and I want to be with you and let the chips fall." Or he could have just married her and left it up to the other man to challenge. It would be more difficult if the marriage had already happened to try to challenge it after the fact. But Boaz isn't willing to do any of that. He's going to be honest and upfront and obvious the way that he does this. And that's a lesson for us as well. There's risk here because he's given this other man a chance to redeem Ruth when he really wants to be with her. And the lesson for us is that sometimes we have to take risks in this world as well. Be willing to give up something that we're really interested in, really motivated about, really excited for, in order to effectively serve the Lord. We have to be willing to make those sacrifices to commit to doing things the way God would have us do them. I'd ask you to keep your place there in Ruth chapter 3, but turn into the New Testament, into the Gospels, and find Mark chapter 8, verses 36 and 37, where Jesus will teach us this lesson by asking us an important question. What would you be willing to sacrifice to serve the Lord? What would you be willing to give up, but to understand the consequences as well? Mark chapter 8, verses 36 and 37. Jesus asked, "What would it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul?" We see that example in Boaz. He was willing to risk this relationship with Ruth, who he really wanted to marry, to go about this in a way that God would approve of. And we're going to see that throughout the rest of this story. That's exactly what Boaz does. So as we continue the story to get back on track, the rest of the night passes. He tells her to stay there with him. He's going to give her some food when she leaves to take home, and he's going to develop his plan. How's he going to approach this situation as honestly and as forthrightly as he can? So let's continue Ruth chapter 3, verses 14 through 18. So Ruth lay at his feet until morning, and she arose before one could recognize another. And then he said to her, "Do not let it be known that the woman came to the threshing floor." Also he said, "Bring the shawl that is on you and hold it." And when she held it, he measured out 6 ephahs of barley and laid it on her. Then she went into the city, and when she came to her mother-in-law, Naomi said, "Is that you, my daughter?" And then she told her all that the man had done for her. And she said, "These 6 ephahs of barley he gave me, for he said to me, 'Do not go empty-handed back to your mother-in-law.'" Then Naomi said, "Sit still, my daughter, until you know how the matter will turn out, for the man will not rest until he has concluded this matter this day." So as we come toward the end of this chapter, Boaz provides for Ruth, as he has done before. He gives her grain to take home to feed her and Naomi, but he does something else, and it's kind of subtle. He does something very respectful, although it might seem contradictory on the surface. We just talked about how honest Boaz is. But now it might seem like, on the surface, that he's telling Ruth to kind of sneak away before the sun comes up. And what he's really doing is he's respecting her, because the fact is that people really haven't changed much in the 3,000 years since these events occurred. And if people would have seen her leaving the threshing floor, although nothing inappropriate happened, what might they have said? What might they have thought? So he's just trying to protect her. Remember, he told her, "Everyone in town knows you as a virtuous woman." Well, he wants to keep it that way. But there's something somewhat strategic going on here as well, if you think about it. He's thinking, how am I going to approach this other relative? He wants to do that above board, but he wants to do it from a position of strength. If there's a rumor about an inappropriate relationship circulating around, that's going to make it more difficult for him to do that. So he's just trying to set this up as beneficially, but as honestly as he can. Let's pause here before we go into chapter 4, where we'll read of this interaction he has with this other relative and how that's resolved. Let's think about the relationship that's developing here. For those that are in that time of life where they're thinking long term, they're thinking about marriage, those who have been married for just a while, or even those that have been married for a long time, it's good to be reminded of the foundation and the basis of a solid, lasting relationship. Because we get a recipe here as we look to Boaz and Ruth, how this relationship developed, the things they have said toward one another. What is that attraction based on? It's not based on anything physical. It's not based on wealth or worldly status. Although Boaz is described as a wealthy man, there's no indication that's what Ruth's really interested in. What's the first thing they notice about one another? Each other's hearts. They notice each other's hearts. And that's the basis of a firm relationship that can last. And as if we're thinking about that, or thinking about advising someone that's in that stage of their life, that's a recipe for success. Find somebody who shares your love of the Lord. Find somebody who shares your love of God's Word that you can see growing together in strength and in faith, and raising a family that does the same. That's the recipe for a lasting relationship. Sadly, we look around this world at so many marriages that end so quickly. It's because they're based on superficial criteria. This is an excellent example of how to build that relationship. We're only scratching the surface. That could be lesson upon lesson upon lesson. But it's a great reference of what that relationship can be like. But let's proceed into chapter 4. Now we have the resolution. Everything will fall into place. Boaz will go and approach this other relative. He will lay out the situation, and there will be a decision. There will be closure. Ruth chapter 4, verses 1 through 6, as we continue the story. Now Boaz went up to the gate and sat down there, and behold, the close relative of whom Boaz had spoken came by. So Boaz said, "Come aside, friend, sit down here." So he came aside and sat down. And then Boaz took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, "Sit down here," so they sat down. And then he said to the close relative, "Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, sold this piece of land which belonged to our brother Elimelech. And I thought to inform you, saying, 'Buy it back in the presence of the inhabitants and the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not redeem it, then tell me that I may know, for there is no one but you to redeem it, and I am next after you.' And he said, 'I will redeem it.' So Boaz said, 'On the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you must also buy it from Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of the dead, to perpetuate the name of the dead through his inheritance.' And the close relative said, 'I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I ruin my own inheritance. You redeem my right of redemption for yourself, for I cannot redeem it.'" First, let's think about this other relative, who kind of gets ambushed, if you think about it, kind of coming through the gate of the city, and Boaz kind of just throws this situation on him. But that was kind of normal. We'll talk about that here in a minute. It is interesting the way that the man is referenced in Scripture, because if you notice, he's never named. He's just called this other relative, this close relative. And how does Boaz address him? In most translations, it says, "Friend, friend, come sit down here and let's talk." Now, obviously, they were family members. Obviously, Boaz knew the man's name. There's this thought that Boaz probably did address him by name, but for some reason, the author is leaving this man anonymous. And again, there are theories and opinions as to why he might be doing that, a few of which I'll share with you because they're kind of interesting. Gives us a little bit of cultural perspective. The first most obvious and probably the most practical one is that it's just not necessary. I mean, there are other characters in the story who aren't named. In chapter 2, the man in charge of the threshers or the reapers is referred to as the man in charge of the reapers. So he's not given a name either. So maybe that's just the case. It's not necessary. But there are a couple other interesting theories or opinions. One is that the man was intentionally left anonymous, really to protect his identity. Because he'll go on to do something that wouldn't necessarily have been looked up to by society at that time, because he has given up his right to redeem this member of his family or his extended family. And so maybe this is just kind of protecting his identity. The other extreme, though, is similar but quite different. It's that he's left anonymous almost as a punishment, as a consequence. That he's kind of an important character in this last chapter, but he doesn't even get credit. He doesn't even get named. He's just kind of nameless throughout history now. Whatever the reason, the man is left anonymous, but the real important part of the passage is the strategy as we see play out. As Boaz, being honest as he can, engages this man about the situation. He does so at the city gate. That is where business such as this would be transacted. It's the most public place in the city. In modern terms, we might say that it would be equated to the town square. There's a lot of foot traffic. People could stop and listen and witness things like this. It's where the elders would sit in judgment. He assembles a bank of 10 witnesses who are elders, who know the law, they know the custom, and they know how this should be done. So again, he's being completely transparent and obvious about the way he does it. He tells the man, as he's offering him this opportunity to be the redeemer, that if he won't do it, Boaz will. There's no hidden agenda. He tells the man exactly where he's coming from. And the first thing that he brings up is actually something that we didn't know about up until this point, which is the fact that Naomi was selling a piece of land. The New King James Version that I'm reading from make it sound as if she had already sold it, likely to a non-family member, not knowing that she had family members, and now this was his chance to redeem it. Most other translations make it sound as if she was going to sell piece of land. At any rate, she had land to sell. This man was either interested or not. This would be the primary thing to consider first in this situation. Do you want to redeem the land or not? Yes or no? It's also a fact that if the answer was no, then that would really clarify things, because Ruth then wouldn't really even be an issue. Because a redeemer had to redeem everything. The land, the property, the widow, it was a package deal. He couldn't pick and choose what he would redeem. So if the man wasn't willing to redeem the land, he probably wasn't willing to then change his mind and take in this foreign widow and buy the land. That's why Boaz presents the land issue first. And of course, the man is interested. It's likely it's a good deal. I mean, he's buying it from a family member. She's kind of desperate. I mean, she's selling this land to put food on the table. So he's probably going to get a pretty good deal. It's probably not surprising that he says yes. But then Boaz brings up this other aspect. If you redeem the land, you have to take the widow into your family. And the man thinks about it. We're not told to, how long. He thinks about it for a little while and he says, you know what? On second thought, maybe I really don't want to redeem this land. There's a thought here that he probably already has a family. And can you consider how awkward that might be? Let's think about that conversation when he gets home that night. In modern terms. So he walks in from a hard day of work out at the harvest, throws his keys on the counter. His wife's in the kitchen kind of getting dinner ready. He says, hey, honey, I'm home. And she says, hey, welcome home. Dinner will be ready in a few minutes. Why don't you wash up? And he says, okay, yeah, you know what? I just wanted to let you know, remember that relative of ours, Elimelech, that died in Moab? Well, he's selling a piece of land, and I got the opportunity to buy it today. So I went ahead and pulled the trigger. I went ahead and took the opportunity to do that. I got it at a good price. And maybe his wife would have said, oh, great, honey, that's good. Why don't you sit down and, you know, I'll pass the green beans over to you. And as that's happening, he would pause and say, and by the way, have you met Ruth and her mother-in-law, Naomi? Because that was the expectation. And that would have been awkward. We almost can't blame the guy for giving up his right to do that. And there is the matter of the inheritance, which is actually what he said. If he had sons, if he had an existing family, the situation would be that he would take Ruth and Naomi into his family. Part of the arrangement, part of the expectation is they would have children to carry on her late husband's name. And then he would have to provide for children and Ruth and Naomi. Then, when he died, if there were any sons from that marriage, that land would go to those sons. It wouldn't be divvied up to his existing family. That's why he says that it would affect my inheritance. And so that's probably why he's not willing to do it. And so he surrenders that right to Boaz, and this leaves the opportunity open for Boaz to become the redeemer. And they seal the transaction in a culturally significant, symbolic way. Let's read verses 7 through 10, how this transaction is concluded. Now this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging to confirm anything. One man took off his sandal and gave it to the other, and this was a confirmation in Israel. Therefore, the close relative said to Boaz, buy it for yourself, and he took off his sandal. And Boaz said to the elders and all the people, you are witnesses this day that I have bought all that was Elimelech's and all that was Chilion's and Mahlon's from the hand of Naomi. Moreover, Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of Mahlon, I have acquired as my wife to perpetuate the name of the dead through his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brethren and from his position at the gate. You are witnesses this day. So the negotiation is completed with the ceremonial passing of a sandal, which might sound kind of odd, but let's go back into the old law. Find Deuteronomy chapter 25. We'll focus on verses 5 through 10, but more specifically verses 7 through 9. Here is where this law and a custom of this kinsman redeemer comes from. Because in Deuteronomy chapter 25, starting in verse 5 up through verse 7, we learn that as part of the law, if a man passed away, his brother specifically would be expected to marry his widow. That's where this comes from. That's where this originated. We see that in play in this interaction between Boaz and this relative. But pay attention to verses 7 through 9. This is where the passing of the sandal comes from. If the man refused that obligation, the widow had recourse. And this is what the widow got to do. Verses 7 through 9. But if the man does not want to take his brother's wife, then let his brother's wife go up to the gate to the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to raise up a name to his brother in Israel. He will not perform the duty of my husband's brother. Then the elders of the city shall call him and speak to him. But if he stands firm and says, I do not want to take her, Then his brother's wife shall come in the presence of the elders, remove his sandal from his foot, spit in his face, and answer and say, so shall it be done to the man who will not build up his brother's house. Now that is some swift justice right there for the widow. Take the man's sandal and spit in his face. That's where this custom of passing the sandal comes from. That's what the man does to Boaz. He is surrendering his right by taking off his shoe and handing it to the other man in the presence of the witnesses. Now, there's no spitting in this transaction. That really had become a custom by this point. The men, although they called Elimelech their brother, it's not necessary to infer that they were literally brothers of Elimelech. They were close relatives, as they're called. So this really isn't a statute of the old law. They're not brothers. So now this is really just a custom. But he passes the sandal. Boaz is getting what he wants. Ruth is getting what she wants. And the other man is too. There's no need for spitting. It really wouldn't add anything to this transaction. So it's just a customary passing of the sandal. You wonder, is that something that Ruth and Boaz kept? I mean, that's something that goes up on the mantle, right? You put it up on the wall. That reminds me of this day when this all came together. That would be a treasured memento, we would think. But let's read toward the conclusion. Now that this case is closed and Ruth and Boaz can be together. The last passage we'll read from this story, from this chapter, is Ruth chapter 4, verses 13 through 15. And then we'll summarize the rest because we understand the important outcome of this union. So verses 13 through 15, as we move toward our conclusion. Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. And when he went into her, the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. And then the women said to Naomi, blessed be the Lord, who has not left you this day without a close relative, and may his name be famous in Israel. And may he be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you, who is better to you than seven sons, has borne him. I just want to state that in the rest of the story here, I think that phrase in verse 15 is powerful. When the women of the village say to Naomi, your daughter-in-law loves you so much that she is better than seven sons. Seven being this perfect, complete number. They're acknowledging that powerful relationship between these two women and the love they had for one another and the encouragement that they give for one another. But if we keep reading, we understand why this union has been so important to the Lord, that he brings all of this to bear. He brings it all into focus and puts it all in place. And I hinted at this last class or last sermon. We go on to read in the story that they'll have a son, and they'll name him Obed. Obed will have a son named Jesse. Jesse will have many sons, but the youngest is David, who will become the greatest king of Israel. And so that in and of itself is important and significant enough. But we realize it certainly doesn't stop there. Because as was prophesied in the Old Testament, and as we turn into the Gospels and we read the genealogy of Jesus, he of course traces his lineage back to David, which means he traces his lineage back to this union between Boaz and Ruth. That is why God has been so interested in bringing them together, paving the way for this union to happen. From it comes a great earthly king. But even more importantly, from this union comes the King of Kings. And we have a lot to learn because God works the same way in our lives. Maybe not with the same dramatic outcome, but he works subtly behind the scenes to make sure that if we are faithful and loyal and obedient, that things in our lives work out and that salvation works for us. Because that's his promise, and that's really what he has offered to us. That's where his plan moves us, is towards salvation. And to conclude, as I did last time, I'd ask you to leave the book of Ruth, leave the Old Testament, and page into the New Testament. And let's find, once again, Galatians chapter 5, verses 22 and 23. Written over 1,000 years after the events that we read about in the book of Ruth by the Apostle Paul, this list of what he refers to as the fruit of the Spirit. And as we read, as we did last time, think about Naomi and Boaz and Ruth and how they give us example of how to apply these qualities and characteristics in our lives towards the people around us. Galatians chapter 5, verses 22 and 23. Paul says, the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against such there is no law. This is our challenge and our opportunity every day to follow their example. These ordinary people who did extraordinary things in service to the Lord with this glorious outcome. This takes no special training, takes no special skill. These are things that we can do now. And I don't mean to suggest that they're easy, because I'm challenged by this. I know sometimes these are difficult, but we have examples in Scripture to guide us. And that's what Ruth and Naomi and Boaz provide for us. And that, my friends, leads us to an invitation, as it normally would, at the end of a lesson. For those of you who are Christians, who have made that commitment, if you're struggling with anything in your life, struggling with sin, if there's something you need to confess, if you need the help of your brethren, this is an opportunity to come forward and make that known so that we can work together, we can help you get back on your track, on track in your journey of service to the Lord. But for those who aren't Christians, and if we can share this message with others, let's remember what Naomi wanted for her daughter-in-law, Ruth, the beginning of chapter 3. She wanted security. She wanted a home for her daughter-in-law because of the love that she had for her. That's what God wants for you. He wants to give you that security. He wants to give you that assurance. And most importantly, He wants to give you a home in eternity. So if you can and need to come forward and be baptized and become a Christian, take that opportunity. Come under the wing of the Lord so He can guide you home. If that invitation applies to anyone in any way, wouldn't you come forward as we stand and we sing together the invitation song?